The Guardian. This week on The Guardian Audio Edition, Tracy Thorn, the accidental pop star. Churches step in to fill the gap left by welfare cuts. And in the book review, we consider Frankenstein by Mary Shelley and Wendy Moore's How to Create the Perfect Wife. To subscribe for free to The Guardian Audio Edition, go to audible.co.uk/Guardian or find us on SoundCloud and iTunes. The Guardian Audio Edition, a new way to get the whole picture.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. For the first time in the short history of the Cameron Clegg coalition, the two leaders are going head to head in a by-election matchup that, on paper at least, is a genuine marginal. With Lib Dem Chris Huhne vacating his seat for a potential stay at Her Majesty's pleasure, the Hampshire seat of Eastleigh is well and truly in play. Also this week, as Ed Miliband becomes the latest party leader to float the merits of a mansion tax, we'll look at the political appeal of soaking the property rich. Joining me to discuss all of this, we have, down the line from Westminster, The Guardian's political correspondent, Juliet Jowett, our data journalist and polling guru, James Ball, and a warm welcome back to the pod for the Lib Dem voice editor, Mark Pack. Now, in what is being seen as a dry run for several southern English seats at the next election, the party machines are working round the clock and coalition harmony has been replaced by partisan discord on the ground. Meanwhile, the Labour candidate and satirist John O'Farrell has been attempting to get the message out that this election is a two-horse race between the coalition candidates and himself. Mark, the bookies now have the Lib Dems as heavy favourites to hang on to this seat that should be close. Do you share their confidence? Was it the kind of thing that makes you nervous?
Instinctively, it's never a happy situation to be in, to be the sort of the bookies' favourite and the front runner a week or so out from polling day, because in a way, expectations can only be dashed from there. I think what is notable, though, is how the media coverage of the campaign has been so dominated by the Tories getting things wrong. I was having a look on sort of Google the other day, just what the top search results are for the Eastleigh by-election. Five out of the top 10 stories were Maria Hutchins messing up something, the Tory candidate, absolutely. Another two of the stories were Maria Hutchins messing up something and Labour messing up something, or Maria Hutchins messing up something and the Lib Dems doing quite well. Two more entries were from Wikipedia, and one entry I was glad to say was from my own blog. But overall, you know, it was just absolutely dominated by the Tory campaign in trouble, by Maria Hutchins making controversial comments and so on. It's really quite remarkable when you consider they have, after all, the Tory party just brought in Linton Crosby to try to get to a grips with their campaign organisation, with their campaign message. They seem to be in a remarkably bad way.
Juliet, what do we know about this woman, Maria Hutchins? Anything? Is she messing up as much as Mark's saying?
Well, she's certainly, people have dragged out sort of old tweets that she's made, interviews. She made some probably ill-advised or at least ill-worded comments about schooling for her, one of her sons as well, suggesting that because he was very talented and wanted to be a top surgeon that none of the local schools were good enough for him. None of these things have played very well. One of the things that's really interesting about her, though, is she very much seems to represent what you might call the sort of UKIP-leaning end of the party. And I think it's just going to be a really interesting test of the Tories, which way the Tories will go in the general election. It's an opportunity for them to fight very much at that end of the party where David Cameron's being pushed away from his kind of natural, more instinctive modernisation. If they do well, that's obviously going to send a very strong message and support the people that want to take that approach at the general election. If they do badly, arguably David Cameron can say, strengthen his hand and say, look, you see, going right doesn't help us. And actually, we need to stick to this modernising message and the kind of the new way forward for the party that he has tried to lay out over the last few years.
James, you keep a look on the polls. There haven't been that many. Have you seen anything that gives you a real clue about which way this is going to go?
No, I think it's quite hard to get anything too sort of informative on by-elections because they're quite volatile and they tend to be sounded out on a whole range of different things. The local candidates, the who's in the field. I mean, one of the good things about choosing Maria Hutchins for the Tories might be that it fended off UKIP. And so they don't have that challenge in terms of building their vote, whereas they'll be hoping that the Lib Dem vote is degraded by Labour. And it's very easy to think of Labour as irrelevant in Eastleigh because we look at them on, I think, 9.6% last election. But that was a blip. Labour are usually on something much closer to about 19% in Eastleigh. And so while they're not in contention, they would expect to be a lot higher, and that could well come from the Lib Dem base. And
so it's the sort of... We're so used to thinking about the tactical vote, but this is like the unwinding of a tactical vote from past election. That's the real danger for the Lib Dems, you think?
I think there's two dangers. There's firstly that Labour are on a very low level of support last time anyway, so that will be higher. And then there may also be some unwinding of tactical voting. So by having a candidate that kept UKIP out so that the Tories don't have the same problem, that's where the shape of a Tory win might come through, not through a sort of insurgent, triumphant win, but through attrition on the other side. That said, it doesn't feel like a given by any stretch of the imagination.
But still, that's some interesting qualification to what's becoming the conventional wisdom, Mark. I mean, another feature of this is insofar as you still have Lib Dem fiefdoms, this is one, isn't it, with the district councillors and the county councillors all being your boys and girls. And I think the Lib Dem vote went up, didn't it, in the local election? In the area,
absolutely. It is one of the strongest areas for the Liberal Democrats around the country. And I think what's significant about it in terms of the test for the Lib Dems is it absolutely puts to the test this idea that in seats where there are Liberal Democrat MPs, the party is really bucking the national trend. There's lots of good evidence for that from local election results, council by-election results, and all up council election results in the usual sort of round of May elections and so on, as indeed we've seen in Eastleigh in previous years, with, as you say, Liberal Democrats continuing to gain in votes and seats. This will actually be a test where people are voting for an MP, though, rather than for councillors or for the local council. I think, you know, the signs so far are that the party will pass that test, but I think it will be very significant in terms of what other Liberal Democrat MPs think and what the mood in the overall party is. One other, I think, noticeable sign is just how many Liberal Democrat activists will be turning up to help. Party membership overall, like actually for both Labour and the Tories, is well down on where it was in the 1990s, but the volume of people turning up to help at the by-election is back to those 1990 Christchurch Newbury by-election
really?
Heydays. Massive influx of people. I mean, each day this week, when I've sort of checked with the HQ on the numbers, there have been over 200 people turning up by lunchtime alone, which in the scale of these things is enormous, enormous levels of help. I suspect partly that's because some of the key organisers, people like Victoria Martin, the campaign manager, were over in the US seeing how the Obama campaign worked at mobilising volunteers to do stuff. And they've imported a lot of those tactics very successfully. But there's also clearly a real desire on the part of the party activists to say, you know, however much we might disagree with each other over some particular policies and some aspects of coalition, here is a real chance for the party to put its best face forward.
But isn't there also something about, you know, if you think back 2 years, if this by-election was being held in early 2011, when Nick Clegg was still being goody-two-shoes with David Cameron, it'd be pretty hard to get a kind of Lib Dem by-election bounce, wouldn't it? But if you've got them picking fights on things, it's much easier to run a strong opposition campaign, ironically, from within government.
Definitely. And that whole mix of how Nick Clegg features in the campaign, I think, is quite interesting as well, in that he has been there regularly. He's had, I think, 3 visits in the last week or so. And some of what the party's doing in government, particularly on income tax, cutting tax for millions of workers, is featuring very heavily in the leaflets. Other parts of the campaign are very, very heavily local, and it's an interesting mix. And although all parties, you know, keep their own internal polling a very closely guarded secret, I think we can fairly safely infer from the fact that Nick Clegg is turning up very regularly that, you know, what the party's own polling is showing is that he is an asset for winning over those Liberal Democrat doubters in Eastleigh.
Juliet, we've talked about the scenario where the Lib Dems win, which might be a shot in the arm in the end for the Conservative modernisers. James gave us some very insightful points on why things could still turn out the other way. If what would now be a shock result, the Conservatives do win, do you think that would have really grave result impact on the coalition? Would it mean that the backbench would get quite restive and say, when we go down the UKIP route, we do rather better?
Well, there's a very strong possibility. I mean, obviously, you know, it's hard to imagine a party leader who, you know, mid-term, not wanting to win a seat that they haven't previously held, if you see what I mean, as in win it off the Lib Dems. So from that point of view, it could be portrayed as good news. But I think it certainly will create potentially some quite awkward dilemmas for David Cameron. You know, and his supporters in the top of the party, the modernisers, as to which way they play it. I mean, it was very noticeable. I was down last week in Eastleigh. I noticed Cameron's gone down there again today, but I was down there last week when he visited. And it was very noticeable that he made such a strong, so many strong points about immigration while he was down there. He made a sort of mini announcement about what the government was doing to review how it deals with sort of benefits and public services and the potential influx of more immigration at the end of this year when restrictions are lifted on Bulgaria and Romania. And then we went down into the centre of the town from where he'd been speaking at a local business. And there you have the kind of UKIP headquarters, slap bang in the middle of town, huge presence there, and up and down the market street on market day. And all their leaflets obviously feature immigration as the number one point. So there's no doubt that he himself is also sort of moderating his message, or at least picking those bits of his message which are most likely to take up UKIP on their own terms. I mean, there are those that argue that once he starts arguing about immigration, he's lost it because he takes it to their territory and he's never going to beat UKIP on immigration. People who want to vote for UKIP on immigration issues are never going to be persuaded by that kind of thing. But it just is a very, very interesting either way it falls for the Conservatives, I think. I just wanted to make one point to contrast with what Mark was saying about the strength of the Liberal Democrat support down there. It's really, really interesting when you speak to people down on the ground who are campaigning from all the major parties. Well, maybe not so much from the Tories because they wouldn't admit it, but certainly Labour and Liberal Democrats, about how many people say on the doorstep they want to vote UKIP, including, and I don't know if Mark would disagree with this, but former Liberal Democrat voters, which seems somewhat extraordinary really, on the surface of it. Some people have speculated that they're both sort of anti-politics parties and maybe that's the appeal. And there are people sort of talking about the possibility that there'll be four parties in the sort of 20 to 30%. You know, I don't know enough about polling to know, you know, obviously this is quite anecdotal, but it's just interesting that you get that from two of the parties, from their campaigners down on the ground, from very seasoned campaigners as well.
Well, we'll have the real numbers next week, yes. Of course. But James, like, you know, we get excited about these by-elections. People like us, saddos, get excited about these by-elections. Most of them are forgotten. There's a few that aren't, you know, Orpington, maybe Crosby, that, you know, represent a big political change. Do you think this is likely to be one that in 5 years' time anyone will remember or not?
I'm not actually all that sure it will. It's fascinating for lots of reasons. You know, it shows, is Labour actually going to be recovering sufficiently in the South East to hold the few seats it has and to pick up a few more next time, which it will need to do? How resilient are the Liberal Democrats? Is the ground operation there? I mean, you get really contradictory signs. You know, as Mark was saying, there's plenty of activists flocking in and the ground game of the Liberal Democrats is famously good. But the fundraising numbers were in this week and Lib Dem fundraising was down last year from about 4 million to 2.5 million. You've got a real sort of parlous state of health for the party there. And then for the Conservatives, this is their sort of test as to whether they should be looking on their right flank and being worried about dropping votes to UKIP, which is a real threat to them. But if they shift too far rightwards in that process, they'll lose people to Labour and the Liberal Democrats. And given that's who they face on the marginals, that's much more damaging. If a voter goes from Tories to UKIP, that's one off a Conservative majority of the seat. If it goes from Conservatives to Labour, that's drops your majority by two because it ups your rival.
Ups them by one as well, yeah.
I just want to say one other thing, actually, sorry, in contrast to Mark about the Lib Dems, which is the reports that the Conservatives are having real problems getting campaigners on the ground, and particularly their prospective parliamentary candidates. One of the sort of Tory blogs was reporting a letter yesterday from the party sort of machinery to candidates, spelling out in no uncertain terms that campaigning was expected from them and a commitment to campaigning because they're very concerned about the sort of poor numbers that have volunteered to go down and help in Eastleigh. I really don't know what to make of this. I think it's really fascinating, though. They've also had problems with their IT systems that help identify voters as well. So they've had quite a lot of sort of campaigning problems, and I think that's interesting. I don't know whether it's just party machinery stuff or whether it says something about how much the candidates are motivated either by Maria Hutchings herself or by the party leader and it's the party's position at the moment. I think it'll be interesting to see what comes out of any kind of inquiry into this by the party later.
OK, well, Juliet's fascinated. James is sceptical as to whether it's going to make it into the book of history. But another chap who keeps an eye on these things is the pollster, YouGov president Peter Kellner, who does have a little hypothesis that this might just prove to be a by-election that could be remembered in nearly 100 years' time. It's at that sort of distance that he's found a close parallel.
The last time you had a peacetime Liberal Conservative coalition, it was just after the First World War. Lloyd George, the Liberal, was Prime Minister. In fact, the Tory party was much bigger in the Commons than the Liberals, but Lloyd George remained Prime Minister. And you then had the Liberals splitting between the Lloyd George Liberals in favour of the coalition and the Asquith Liberals who were against it. Now, in Newport, the seat was won in the 1918 election by a pro-coalition Liberal. He died, and in 1922, late in the year, there was a by-election. And the Conservative who fought it was part of the growing group of Conservatives who were unhappy about the Conservatives being in a Lloyd George-led coalition. And there was quite a lot of grumbling of discontent around the Conservative leadership of Austen Chamberlain. And the Conservative candidate in Newport was part of that growing sort of band of disaffection. The Liberal candidate tried to sort of straddle the Lloyd George and Asquith camps and wasn't clearly defined as either pro or anti-coalition. But the point was, the Tories are expected to be thrashed in it, partly by the Liberals and partly by the Labour Party coming up on the rails. And a meeting was called at the Carlton Club in London for the Friday morning, the morning after the election, when they expected to discuss the consequences of the Conservatives' dire performance in the by-election. But about 2 in the morning, the result was declared, and hey presto, the Conservatives took the seat with a pretty clear majority. Labour was second, Liberals third. And what the by-election indicated, if anything, was actually the Tories were way out in front. This was the long before opinion polls. They had no longer had need of the Liberals, who were on their way out. So Austen Chamberlain turned up at this meeting of Tory MPs at the Carlton Club and vainly tried to argue that the coalition should continue. But there was a vote, and by more than 2-1, the Tory MPs voted against Austen Chamberlain and said, we must withdraw from the coalition. Well, the long-term consequence, incidentally, is that this meeting was the start of what is now called the 1922 Committee of Tory Backbenchers. The 1922 Committee is named precisely after that particular meeting. The immediate consequence, Chamberlain resigned as Tory leader, Bonar Law took over, pulled out of the coalition, forced a general election that was held just a few weeks later, which the Conservatives won easily. And that was the end, until Nick Clegg came along, of the Liberals playing any role in peacetime government in Britain. One tiny historical note that is worth adding, because a lot has been written, most famously in the book, The Strange Death of Liberal England. Well, one of the oddities of the campaign was the Liberal and Labour candidates were both on the side of temperance and held their meetings in the Temperance Hall in Newport. The Conservative candidate was supported by the Licensed Vigilers Association and was in favour of alcohol and drinkers. And it looks as if a fair number of working class voters voted Tory, not on ideology, not on judgments of the coalition, but on the freedom to drink. So it may be that the final nail in the coffin of a liberal England, unquote, was delivered actually not in England at all, but by the drinkers of South Wales.
So if Tory candidate Maria Hutchings gets around him for everyone, she could bring the whole House of Cards crashing down this time, just maybe. But Peter, seriously, you're a pollster as well, of course, as a historian, if you like, if we've just been hearing. And how do you think it's looking? We know the bookies are putting their money on the Liberal Democrats holding on, despite their terrible performance in the national polls at the moment. Do you think they're right?
I'd keep my money in my pocket, to be honest. If forced at gunpoint to say I had to bet one side or the other, I think the Liberal Democrats are more likely to win. And my reason is this, but I say this with a week to go, and who knows what will happen in the final week, that You've got, in a sense, two contests going on. You've got the Liberal Democrats trying to squeeze the Labour vote, saying, OK, we're in coalition, but we're not the Tories. Labour has no chance of winning. If you want to defeat the Tories, you have to vote Liberal Democrat. So you've got that tactical argument going along. And then you've got the Conservatives saying to their unhappy supporters who voted Tory in 2010, but are now thinking about voting UKIP, they're saying, look, if you vote UKIP, UKIP can't win. You'll let the Liberals in. They're pro-European. Actually, if you want to keep a pro-European out of Westminster, you really got to vote Tory, not UKIP. And all the signs, both locally that I've been able to pick up, and certainly nationally, and YouGov polling we've done shows this, is that at the moment, the Liberal Democrats are more easily able in LibCon contests to squeeze the Labour vote than the Tories are to squeeze the UKIP vote. So if the Liberals can get, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 Labour people to vote tactically for the Lib Dems, and the Tories fail to squeeze the UKIP vote, I think that would tip it in favour of the Liberal Democrats.
Peter Kellner there. You can follow all of the build-up to the Eastleigh by-election on our rolling blog, full coverage at guardian.co.uk/politics. Now, a so-called mansion tax on multi-million pound properties has long been a favourite policy of the Lib Dems. It's rare to see Vince Cable in particular interviewed at any length at all, without him enthusing about it. But as of this week, Ed Miliband has mounted the same hobby horse. The Labour leader pledged support in a recent speech for a tax on all homes worth more than £2 million. James, first of all, let's leave the politics aside. Do you think this is going to help fix the public finances, potentially?
There's all sorts of nonsense talked about this kind of mansion tax, about this idea of suddenly if you own a property worth £2 million rather than £1.9 million, you'd pay £20,000 a year and all of this. And actually, when you start getting into the details of it, it's really a pretty modest proposal, and it works in a fairly sensible way, in that essentially, as it's been proposed generally by the Liberal Democrats and Labour, you would pay a certain percentage of your property price above £2 million.
Yep.
So if it's worth £2.1 million, you only pay it on £100,000 worth each year. And so this is quite a small portion of people. We should remember that there's only about 75,000 homes worth more than £2 million. People will only pay a small amount. And these are quite well-established taxes. This isn't some sort of new tax system that isn't tested anywhere. It's used right across America, actually, for state taxes.
You can't move the building out of the country, unlike some things, can you?
Exactly. It's hard to move. It's good at targeting high-income people. America uses it. Ireland is introducing one next year. It's in Denmark. It's in Canada. So it's quite an established system. It won't raise a huge amount of money set that high, and especially set to taper in, which is sensible. So,
but do we know what these really big properties, as you say, they're so rare, do we really know what they're worth until they're sold?
Often you don't, and that's one of the sort of trickier things. Do you start introducing regular valuations akin to what you do for council tax and so on, or not? I mean, these things trade. Some months you only see 80 or 100 homes worth more than 2 million sell. So there's quite a slow rate of turnover in them as well. So that's the wrinkle, but it's not a huge number of properties. It's pretty feasible to think you could do it. It will raise some money, but not lots.
Yeah. Okay, so small beans, but kind of nourishing small beans by the sounds of it.
It's not going to bankrupt anybody, and it will raise some money, and it's hard to dodge.
Mark, now, imitation's a sincerest form of flattery and all of that. For the Lib Dems, is it good news then that Ed Miliband's made a raid for one of their most high-profile policies?
I think it is quite good news, because there are many plus sides to the mansion tax in terms of, as you were saying, it's very hard to dodge a tax because property is a physical, tangible thing that's firmly located in one place. It's very hard to hide. And in terms of basic fairness about the balance between taxing wealth and income, it's also the case there are, you know, as with any sort of new tax proposal, a few extreme cases where you can point to somebody in a particular situation where you sort of think, that tax is really not going to work very well for that particular person. So it's very likely that people like the Daily Mail will be all over attacks like this and attacking it quite heavily. And we've seen a little bit of that in the last couple of years. So having another of the major political parties arguing for something quite similar is actually very helpful in terms of being able to win that overall public argument in favour of tax. It also obviously sets up, you know, any future hung parliament negotiations after the next general election quite interestingly, because it's another of several issues now where it looks like Labour is warming quite a lot to various Liberal Democrat policies. And that obviously means that if there is any real choice in a hung parliament negotiations, the Labour is perhaps preparing the ground for trying to run those negotiations rather more successfully than the dreadful fiasco of the Labour non-negotiating team that there was in 2010.
But Juliet, interesting pointer for 2015, but there's going to be an opportunity for Labour to make a bit of trouble on this sooner than that, isn't there? Because they can put down a motion about this and challenge the Lib Dem MPs to back their own policy.
There is, and actually maybe it's of more interest to people in what they describe as the Westminster Village than anyone else, but it's given rise to some sort of fantastic shenanigans, really, with the Labour Party saying that they want an opposition day motion before the budget, in which they appear to be kind of heading towards a motion which they think will make it sort of relatively easy for Liberal Democrats, MPs and ministers to vote with them, or at least hard for them not to, as it will be just in principle support for the idea. They also have said that they won't tie it to their call to reintroduce the tenpence tax band, which Ed Miliband has himself linked the two policies, but the Liberal Democrats oppose that. So
they're making it very, very hard for the Lib Dems to oppose.
Exactly. They want the Lib Dems to vote with them. This is obviously an attempt to sort of split the coalition, get Lib Dems to sort of troop through the lobbies with Labour rather than with their coalition partners on the Conservative benches, which is always tricky. It was actually, I think, on Mark's blog. It might have been written by Stephen Tall. Forgive me, Mark, if I got this wrong, but there was a really interesting piece earlier this week about the problems Ed Miliband might be storing up for himself in the future, though, with encouraging coalition partners to divide on key policies like this. And if he was to try and form a government with the Liberal Democrats after the next general election, if there was no one outright winner of the election in 2015, that it would be hard for him then to argue against Lib Dems going through the lobbies with the Conservative opposition in the future, something that Ed Miliband looks maybe constitutionally not very comfortable with, or naturally not very comfortable with such an idea. Certainly Labour have normally been a reasonably controlling party on these sorts of things. But it might be very hard for him to sort of take the moral high ground on this, having encouraged them to do it so much in this Parliament.
Stranger things have happened in politics than someone doing that and then taking the moral high ground later. Mark, do you think that the proposition as Juliet sets it up, do you think significant numbers of Lib Dem MPs would feel they'd got to vote for it because it's their policy, or do you think they'll say, oh, it's a Labour trap, we're not walking into it?
I think that's very much still up in the air in terms of exactly what gets proposed and with the Opposition Day debate and so on. I mean, as Juliet said, this is a little bit of sort of political games playing about Westminster bubble stuff that isn't really hugely significant. And I think what puzzles me in a way is that on the one hand, Labour is being quite smart, particularly this decoupling mansion tax from 10p tax to try to appeal to Liberal Democrat. On the other hand, there is a little bit of the William Hague about Ed Miliband's approach to being leader of the opposition in terms of just being a little too keen to play the Westminster bubble game and missing out on the opportunity to actually establish himself as a plausible Prime Minister. You know, if you say, what is Ed Miliband's big challenge at the moment? It's that quite a lot of people say, oh, yeah, I'll probably vote Labour, but, you know, I just can't quite see Ed Miliband as Prime Minister. Mm. And this sort of political games playing doesn't, you know, not only does it not help address that problem, if anything, it makes it worse. And so I'm just surprised that Labour are wanting to go down this route when surely their interest would be in terms of saying, no, we're above such political game playing, we're serious about power, we've got gravitas.
Unless they're going
substance.
With the theory that all politics is relative and, you know, you just make the government look more unstable and you'll look more orderly by contrast. I mean,
possibly, although, you know, given all the arguments there are within Labour over what its tax approach should be and all the stuff there's been in the last few days about whether Ed Miliband should be Shadow Chancellor and continuous Shadow Chancellor and so on, with Matthew Seldon coming out against that, if you do want to present yourself as United Party, this is not the topic of which to lead with.
James, there's something going on here, isn't there? You know, in terms of just the fact that whereas it always used to be parties competing about different tax cuts, different giveaways, it still is. And we'll talk about 10p in 1 second. But it's just interesting that they're now competing for different ways to raise money off rich people. That's a change, isn't it?
It is definitely a shift, but I think it's largely coming out of there is, however popular benefit cuts and so on are with a large portion of the country, they are deeply unpopular with another section. And so there's a real need to keep this sense of fairness in what's going on and in the revenue raising measures. And so doing something to target sort of those who are wealthier and more able to take it, I think, is definitely quite in the culture, whether it's tackling tax avoidance or taxing properties. You know, I think the tricky thing for opposition is in the midterm, this is a policy that could very easily be introduced by the coalition as a sort of token for the Liberal Democrats in exchange for something else. If you want any wins, if you want to be associated with any popular policies while in opposition, you've kind of got to hitch yourself to them quite closely and quite aggressively. And that occasionally means playing silly games like Miliband is doing. I think if say next year the coalition were to introduce something resembling this mansion tax, at least now Ed Miliband could try and claim some association with it.
Yeah.
If he wasn't playing this kind of Westminster bubble game,
no one would know what his position was.
Exactly that. And so there is a certain sort of grudging logic to it. But, you know, I can see how you can play it either way, but you can see why Ed's doing what he's doing.
Juliet, let's just turn to that 10p tax story now, which Ed Miliband tied together with the mansion tax. The main argument on the day seemed to be he was no longer Gordon Brown's boy because he was going to reintroduce the thing that Gordon Brown had made such a bumbling mess of abolishing.
Yes, and I suppose, I mean, it's a very tricky thing for them because both Ed Miliband and Ed Balls were, you know, very senior levels within the Labour Party at the end of the last government. And before that, they had been very closely advising and associated with Gordon Brown, the Chancellor. So it's hard for them to sort of slough off any kind of bad feeling or criticism of the way Labour handled, obviously, the economy in particular. But no, it is quite significant. I mean, not everybody is entirely convinced by the sincerity of it. But Ed Miliband did have quite an impressive record of standing up to Cabinet colleagues, or at least making very vocal within Cabinet his objections to policies, including, for example, his opposition to Labour's support for expanding Heathrow Airport, for example, when he was the Energy and Climate Change Secretary. Ed Balls also sometimes stood up to them, arguing very hard in favour of extending the 50p rate of tax towards the end of the last Parliament as well. So it's not implausible that they would have had different views. But it's a difficult game for them to play without trying to sort of cast off the entire 13 years as well. So there are some quite interesting figures about what it would cost, and I don't think the mansion tax is in any way an adequate explanation of how they would afford this. The House of Commons Library estimates it would cost about £6 billion to reintroduce it. The Treasury estimates about £7 billion. So I think even the Liberal Democrat estimates of the income from the mansion tax are about £2 billion. Mm. So there's a pretty big gap there. I know Ed Miliband is suggesting a much narrower 10p tax than we had before. But even so, I'm not sure it's entirely credible yet as a sort of financial, you know, as a sort of numbers game.
You can complain, Mark, that it's a bit narrow. And so you could say it makes the tax system more complicated compared to your much vaunted increase in the personal allowance. But really, these policies are pretty much identical, aren't they?
Well, I think there is a huge advantage about taking more people out of the tax system altogether in terms of the sheer simplicity of that, not only in terms of the administration, but actually also for the individuals involved. And I think it's very easy for people who are very used to and maybe even enjoy filling in forms, and I'll put myself in that category. You know, give me a form, I will happily fill it in till
form
the cows come home.
Weekly, we'll invite you back for next time.
But actually, for a lot of people, handling those sorts of combination of bureaucracy and arithmetic is actually a real challenge. And I think that we hugely undervalue the benefits of simple systems, and therefore having a relatively small number of tax rates and concentrating on taking people out of the tax system, I think, is a much better way of helping people than adding in extra complexity.
Okay, that makes sense. James?
So I think it's kind of misleading, and it's so often said, and it shouldn't be allowed to be, to talk about taking people out of the tax system. It's taking people out of the income tax system, indeed, which is only about a quarter of all tax revenues. And, I mean, there's a sort of traditional left-wing argument that, you know, it's good for everyone to pay a little bit of tax because they have a sense of having contributed to the system. I think if you talk about low earners being taken out of the tax system, people may feel like they haven't put in and so don't deserve what comes out of it, when they still actually pay a lot of income in tax.
National insurance and VAT and whatever.
VAT and council taxes and all sorts of other things. But, you know, sort of more broadly, you have the question of, is this a good way to spend money? When you start moving the tax thresholds, you really help sort of people on second incomes, people with a part-time job who's married to a full-time earner, that kind of thing. And you really help people at the top end of the basic rate, often without sort of kids or anything like that, people like myself, frankly. And it's very nice for me, but I think in the current climate, are people like me the ones that need that kind of spending on them? Not necessarily. So there's lots to be said for doing it, and there's lots to be said for 10p rates to sort of, in, you know, make it a little bit more gentle as you start coming into income tax brackets. But whether it's actually a spending priority that helps people struggling with poverty, people struggling to pay the bills, I think is a much, much more open question.
Well, they say the voters don't do gratitude. James has got three party leaders falling over each other trying to help him, and he doesn't want it. So this, of course, all takes place in advance of next month's budget, which just got a little bit more complicated yesterday with the long-awaited auction of 4G licences, which a decade or so ago, there was one that brought in £23 billion or something. Now it's brought in £2 billion, £1 billion less than expected. The significant of that, Juliet, is that George Osborne relied on this and other moves in order to claim that borrowing was not going up but going down during the double dip recession in his autumn statement. If he has to admit it's going the other way in his budget, it's going to be a bit difficult for him, isn't it?
Oh, it would be disastrous, because, I mean, obviously they are not able to say that they're bringing down the debt yet. So bringing down the deficit is something they cling on to very dearly. I'm afraid that I'm not close enough to the grand figures to know how much difference this £1 billion will make or how marginal this is. But, I mean, don't forget, as well as the kind of political message, which will be crucial for them, there is also just, you know, yet more pressure on public spending if they're £1 billion short as well. I mean, we've seen today's stories about moving money from the aid budget to pay for things like peacekeeping and even demobilisation from combat zones and things in the military. So it's getting pretty desperate and tight. And while, you know, many ministers preach austerity as a general practice, none of them want it in their own department. So I imagine that the negotiations around the cabinet table over the budget are going to get harder and harder.
Well, thank you very much indeed for that, Julia, and to James and Mark as well. That's all we've got time for this week. We'll be back to chew over the results of Eastleigh next time. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much indeed for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.